the conspiracy. Again, they were opened prior to any alleged conspiracy. There simply was no connection.
None at all.
None at all.
Direct or indirect.
Direct or indirect. The fact that the mailboxes were connected to each other does not, there's no associative property that somehow makes those mailboxes therefore part of the conspiracy.
So they weren't used to help him conceal his identity or the proceeds of his fraudulent activity.
There's absolutely no evidence that they had any connection to the conspiracy. The fact was that
so
he opened
the Business Express, for instance, that was used as the fake address in the application for that mailboxes for you box. Without that box, would he have been able to conceal his real address?
Well, he could have made up an address for starters. So the fact that he used a mailbox that he actually does rent, an address that actually does link to him, indicates that he wasn't attempting to conceal anything. And it certainly doesn't implicate that mailbox in any mailings or treasury checks or the actual acts that were alleged
well,
in this particular
you,
case.
I'd be really grateful if you could explain to me how, without the Business Express box or without the Newport mailbox, how he would have been able to conceal his real address from anyone who traced the conspiracy mailbox. The conspiracy mailings back to the mailboxes for you.
He could have made up an address. He could have fabricated an address. He could have used the address on the driver's license that played such a large part in his trial, the fake driver's license, the driver's license that were
but
addresses that didn't belong to him.
The existence of the mailbox facilitated his activity, didn't it?
Only, I would not say that they facilitated. I would say that the mailboxes for you mailbox had a connection by the address being receiving the mailings. But the Business Express simply does not have a connection. And the fact that he used that address, an address that was connected to him, shows that he was not intending to conceal anything, including the proceeds.
He
could have just made up an address.
He used that as the fake address in the application for the mailboxes for you box, didn't he?
Yes. But it doesn't somehow then become part of the conspiracy. It didn't receive any mailings. There were no checks sent there. There was no evidence he did anything illegal with that mailbox other than put it on an application for another mailbox.
Go ahead.
Does he have to show that he did something illegal with the mailbox?
Yeah, it has to show that it's connected to the alleged acts of the conspiracy.
Well, how could it be?
It's mere appearance.
How could it be less connected? For instance, let's look at the Roadrunner. He used this address to open his Wells Fargo bank account in order to receive the proceeds of the fraudulently cashed checks. Surely you can see that that's step one, and then we have step two, step three.
All I would say is that other than the mailboxes for you and Roadrunner, there simply was no connection other than him filling it out. And if he wanted to conceal himself, I'm sorry, I see that my time is nearing. I'd like to talk about sentencing if you have any questions about it. But.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Mr. Reschter?
May it please the Court. I'm Daniel D. Reschter, Jr., and I represent defendant appellant Jonathan Bernard Culbert, Jr., and he was an employee at the Postal Distribution Center in Los Angeles. And we have some issues to take a look at, issues which I feel would require at least a reversal of the court's findings on and give us a new trial, or the latter issues relative to sentencing. The first issue is one that I do every once in a while here, and that's probable cause on a search warrant. And in this particular case, the affidavit that was filled in, nice big long affidavit, but there are only five paragraphs in there that even touch on Mr. Culbert. And interestingly enough, two of them contain contentions which would lead one to believe that he wasn't involved. One of the conspirators says to another one, Well, it's a mail carrier who's giving us this checks. By the way, to mention, obviously we had separate trials and separate spokes of an alleged conspiracy. The other contention was won by another person, conspirator, who at the moment of arrest said, oh yes, it's two female postal employees who are supplying checks to the conspiracy to get it to go. Well, it turns out that Mr. Culbert was never a carrier. Furthermore, he was, to my knowledge, never a female. He did. The only other allegations in there that give us any match at all is that the times when these checks were taken are times when he worked there. He was a full-time employee at the Postal Distribution Office. That hardly creates probable cause.
Well, let's go through it. At the time of the warrant, the time the warrant was issued, here's what the government knew. They knew that Cheryl Culbert, Johnny Culbert's sister, was part of a Treasury check-stealing conspiracy. They know that a postal carrier in California is stealing checks for the conspiracy. They know that Cheryl's brother, Jonathan, was a postal carrier in California. They know that Jonathan Culbert worked in a postal facility that processed the checks that had been stolen. Does someone have to see him take the checks? What do you think we need?
First of all, he was not a postal carrier. He was just a regular employee in the distribution center.
Right.
What
he
do I think they need?
Facility.
I think they need a tie to at least one check. If they could have put in there, he worked on such and such a day, and on such and such a day specifically, this particular check went on through. It could not be hard to do. They had over $400,000 worth of checks that they could have looked at. This was a fishing expedition. As you point out so well, yeah, he is related. Okay, that's a strike against him. Well, he does work in the postal station. Maybe he's not a character, maybe he's not a woman, but he works there. It was a fishing expedition, and it was a fishing expedition that went long after the fish were gone from the pond. This was, I believe, in November of 2002, a year and 3 months after his purported activity in this particular operation. And when you go on a fishing expedition, in my opinion, and I think it should be the opinion of the court, you also forego any ability to use that famous deus ex machina of good faith. You can't have good faith when you knowingly show a magistrate a very nice, long, detailed affidavit for a search warrant, which has a paucity of any contentions against the particular person you're going against. You confront the magistrate with this. You know you're going for a fishing expedition. And quite frankly, good faith cannot support shoddy work, incomplete work, or a fishing expedition. It just simply shouldn't. Now, the 404B evidence was a series of checks that I refer to as the Moody Flowers checks. Now, these were checks that came out, I believe, November of 2001 through, I believe, May of 2002. Not only are they remote in time, but Mr. Moody got the checks from an individual named Marlon Flowers. Marlon Flowers would not have been able to testify at the trial. He had been in a car accident, he had brain damage, and he was unavailable. So we have a person named Alan Moody who cut a deal with the government, and as part of that deal with the government, testifies relative to these checks. Now, I know I did contend that the statements would have involved hearsay, and the government contends that, well, no, these were statements made in the furtherance of a conspiracy. They're in the situation where they get to label that as a conspiracy. I am in a position where, as trying attorney, I'm completely prejudiced. The only person who gives them that particular ability is their witness who's getting a benefit from them, and I have that in that third person. I can't question them. I can't get them in there. That what it does is, and 404B evidence has a tendency of doing this, is it gums up what otherwise would be a decent trial on the merits. It wasn't necessary. Government contends that, well, it helped to show that he had the opportunity to take a check. Again, He worked in the distribution center. They had checks going through there. I don't think they needed this for opportunity. They needed this to put a thumb on the scale of justice, and they shouldn't have done it. Messed up the trial. We should go back.
Did your client deny that he had an opportunity to steal the checks?
He pointed out that there was supervision, and it would have made it darn hard for him to do it. On the other hand, no, there were some checks that would have come through either on the machine he was working in or in an area adjacent to where he was working.
But given his statement, doesn't that make this evidence relevant and probative on the degree to which he had an opportunity?
No, because the government also produced an individual who was a supervisor that worked at that particular facility and was able to explain the opportunity situation.
Well, that just permits the jury to weigh the evidence. It doesn't make this evidence necessarily not probative. Right?
Well, Your Honor, for the little bit of probativity, you put in just too much prejudicial evidence.
That's a 403 problem, right?
And unduly prejudicial, yes.
So you're arguing 403 at that point, not 404.
Yeah.
I'm willing to amend that, yes. Thank you very much. I see that I likewise have gone on. Thank you.
Mrs. Hoffman?
Yep. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Gail Hoffman. I represent the United States of America. And I will take this opportunity to address some of the points raised by counsel. First of all, with respect to the mailboxes that were presented at trial, Mr. Watts built a house of cards. Each and every item he presented on these different applications was fraudulent. When he opened the checking and savings account at Wells Fargo, he listed the address on Magnolia. That was the Roadrunner address. If you go back to look at the Roadrunner application, he provides a fictitious business address and residential address.
Ms. Hoffman, forgive me, but I could see a pretty significant link between each of the mailboxes and the fraud scheme, except for the White Gate postal box. Other than the fact that this was yet another box opened under false pretenses, what connection did that box have to the check fraud?
Do you mean the one in Newport Beach, just so I know?
Yeah.
Okay. With respect to that one, he lists, again, another piece of fraudulent information. On his California driver's license, he lists the address of 351 Old Newport Boulevard Road, and that's the address of the Newport mailbox. And then that, when you go back to that, in order to rent the Newport mailbox, he lists the address of the Business Express mailbox. And the Business Express mailbox, then if you go to look at that application, doesn't list a home address, and he doesn't list a business address. So what he's trying to do is conceal his location. He owned a fairly valuable property, which ultimately the government forfeited on Baguette Road. And in fact, when Mr. Watts was trying to post bond, his wife came in and indicated that she was the cousin and she solely owned that property. So he was, even after indictment and arrest, he was trying to distance himself from his true residence. So at each and every location, he tried to distance himself, physically distance himself from any of his identifications used. So given that concealment is an element of money laundering, and he concealed his address and his specifics all along the road, this is relevant and necessary in order to establish an element of the offense. In addition, Mr. Watts had only met Mr. Vaughn once. Mr. Watts came to drop off something at a location where Mr. Vaughn was visiting, and Mr. Vaughn was the hub for these different conspiracies. And Mr. Watts drove up in a Cadillac Escalade, and Mr. Vaughn said, "That's a great car. Did you buy it legally or illegally?" And then the conversation went into various, how they could help each other, and that was was the only time that they met shortly thereafter. The scheme started, and they engaged in these activities with the stolen United States Treasury checks. So for those reasons, this information was relevant and necessary to establish Mr. Watts' guilt.
Was Cheryl Watts ever charged?
She was not.
Okay.
Under the provision that allows a sentencing enhancement if you recruit someone, the person you recruit have to be a knowing participant in the illegality? Is it enough to simply use someone, even if that someone is not a knowing participant?
Yes, Your Honor, because the enhancement is to the person that recruits the other individual. And so, therefore, whether or not she's knowing is almost, with all due respect, irrelevant, because that person's function serves a useful point in the conspiracy.
But is there a difference between recruiting someone who becomes a knowing participant? Is that that create a different kind of danger than recruiting or just simply using someone who is an unwitting tool?
Well, it would create a different type of danger, because then you're bringing someone else into the fold and exposing
yeah.
someone else to criminal liability and perhaps broadening the conspiracy in some way by bringing in another person who's able to function as a member. Because I was not the AUSA who prosecuted the case, I can't tell you why she wasn't charged. I only know that she wasn't charged. However, given the standard of clear error, and also given the standard that the judge needed to apply in order to enhance him for that role, it's clear that he recruited her in order to facilitate the conspiracy, whether she knew or not.
Although, if as a matter of law, the enhancement is only applicable if one recruits into the conspiracy a knowing participant, then the judge would have been wrong, period, as a matter of law, to have given the enhancement unless there was evidence that she was a knowing participant, right?
If that's the law, that would be correct. However, in this particular case, I think there's a strong argument to be made that she was a knowing participant.
On what basis?
On the facts that were developed. In this particular instance, she's married to her husband. She's married to...
Cuts the other way. People in the same households can't avoid entirely the activities of someone else who lives in the household.
No, I understand, but the way the account was used doesn't make any sense. It was opened on the same day that Mr. Vaughn tried to deposit approximately $4,000 check that represented the proceeds of the stolen U.S. Treasury into that account. Unfortunately for everyone, Mr. Vaughn had the wrong account number listed on the deposit slip, so the check never made it into the account, but she also used fictitious information to apply for that account, and she listed an employer that was that Mr. Watts listed as his employer, and that information was never able to be verified.
So in your view, we don't really need to reach the issue?
No, I don't. I mean, given the facts as they stand on the record,
What is the rule of law? Does the recruit have to know what he's getting into or not?
To be perfectly honest, I can't cite a case to you with respect to that rule of law. I don't believe, based on other circumstances and other cases that I've handled, that the recruit does need to know about the illegal activity. But regardless of that, in this particular case...
Right, you said that.
Right, given the specifics...
You said that.
Thank you. The next issue that I'll turn to is the probable cause that was raised by Mr. Reschiter, who represents Mr. Colbert. And first of all, as it relates to, as the court is aware, the Holy Family check that was stolen from the distribution center.
I'm going to focus you on something regarding this, if I might, because the affidavit for the warrant to search his residence, merely stated that based on the training and experience of the officer and persons involved in these types of check-stealing schemes commonly have in their possession the types of documents that were sought to be seized here. And it says nothing about where these types of individuals commonly retain these documents, and it says nothing about the documents being retained in the residence. Doesn't the warrant have to state that the documents are likely to be found in his home, not merely that he's likely to have them in his possession under these circumstances?
Well, given the affidavit as a whole, in terms of all the other information that's set out about where documents are likely to be found, I believe taken as a whole that there's an inference or a statement that the documents will be found on the premises to be searched. That would be his residence that's listed in the particular in the search warrant.
Why would documents be likely to be found in his house? Intuitively, it seems to me it would be just the opposite. I mean, that a criminal would take pains not to retain the evidence in his home. I mean, you know, a safe deposit box locked away somewhere in a tin can, a relative's house, you know, sort of anywhere, anywhere but at his home. You know, I mean, what evidence is there that these types of criminals keep evidence of their crimes in their homes?
Well, this was a search for documents, and the IRS agent who was the affiant indicated that based on his training and experience, he knows that individuals who are engaged in these type of activities often keep documents close to them. And one would think that these type of documents wouldn't be so close to them so that they would be so easily connected. But unfortunately, sometimes the criminal mind is unfathomable. I mean, why would someone who drives up in a car, why would those two people, after having met each other for less than 30 seconds, start talking about illegal activity? And why would Mr. Vaughn say, well, did you buy, that's a great car, did you buy it? Did you buy it legally or illegally? In another case recently, why would someone keep a dead mink in the freezer? That was another case that I recently had where you were on the panel. I can't answer that question, but the IRS agent, based on his training and experience, did commonly find that individuals engaged in fraud would keep documents within their residence. I see. And if the court does find that there is no probable cause, Leon would apply. There's no evidence to show that the magistrate was not neutral and detached, nor that the officer did not present this affidavit in good faith. In fact, it was presented to a magistrate that was out of district. This is a case prosecuted in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and the search warrant was obtained in the Los Angeles area in California. Absent any other questions, the government rests on its brief.
Thank you, Ms. Hodges.
Thank you.
Ms. Schifrin or Mr. Reschuter, do you have anything further?
Yes, I'd just like to address this issue of the recruitment of Cheryl Watts for the purposes of sentencing. The notes to 3B11 say that in order to get an enhancement for recruitment, the person must be a criminally responsible participant. This person has to have knowledge that they are participating in a criminal activity. There was absolutely no evidence that Cheryl Watts had any knowledge of any criminal activity, that she was involved in criminal activity. She was never asked about it. She was not involved in the trial, and no charges were ever brought against Cheryl Watts. And so I think that enhancement of plus two is obviously an error. The other thing I'd like to just point out is that for the purposes of sentencing, there was a $24,000 check that was included that had again, no connection to the charged conspiracy. It was not a treasury check. It was deposited in a Bank of America account in Florida. It had absolutely no connection to any of the acts of the conspiracy, and it was a discrete separate act that should have been charged separately if it was, you know, a criminal activity. And therefore, I also think that the plus two enhancement for those Washington Square checks should also have been reduced. I'm out of time. I'm sorry. So.
Thank you, Ms. Schiffer. Mr. Reschuter, you have anything further?
Thank you very much. I was not able to, in my initial argument, to get to the sentencing issues. I don't want the court to think that those are minor.
Well, rebuttal is not when you, you know,
yeah.
Address.
Those were important. I just want the court to be mindful of that. But on rebuttal, I do wish to address the one issue relative to that search warrant. Remember that that was executed, I believe, while the affidavit, November 20th, 2002, 1 year, 3 months after Mr. Culbert's alleged activity in this particular case. I would kindly submit that it was done based on the training and expertise and experience of that agent that he, quite frankly, wanted to go fishing. Now, if there are any other questions, I do have a little bit of time. If you have any questions on any other issues, I'd be happy to handle them.
Thank you, Mr. Reschuter and Ms. Schifrin. You were both
thank you very much.
Were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. Of course, thank Ms. Hoffman.